The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And now we move right into the main stories. The first headline, a not guilty verdict for Zimmerman. What happened? George Zimmerman's acquittal in the killing of black teenager Trayvon Martin triggered demonstrations in cities across the country this week and sparked demands that the Department of Justice bring civil rights charges on the case. The six-woman Florida jury, five whites and one Hispanic, found Zimmerman not guilty of both second-degree murder and manslaughter last Saturday after 16 hours of deliberations. Prosecutors had accused the 30-year-old neighborhood watch volunteer of being a wannabe cop who racially profiled the unarmed 17-year-old and provoked the fatal confrontation in a gated community in Sanford, Florida. Zimmerman insisted he shot Martin in self-defense after the teen attacked him. Defense attorney Marco Mira said Zimmerman was prosecuted only because of political pressure, and that if his client were black, he never would have been charged with the crime. Martin's family was expected to file a civil lawsuit charging Zimmerman with wrongful death. "Even though I am brokenhearted," said Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, "my faith is unshattered. I will always love my baby Trey." As thousands of protesters took to the streets in New York, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other cities, Attorney General Eric Holder said that his department would continue an ongoing civil rights investigation into the killing, which he called tragic and unnecessary. But legal experts said it would be difficult to prove Zimmerman killed Martin because he was black, making a civil rights case unlikely. In an interview, one juror identified only as B-37 said the jury was initially divided, with two members voting for manslaughter and one for second-degree murder. Ultimately, she said, jurors decided that George feared for his life during his confrontation with Martin and that Florida law dictated an acquittal. What the editorial said. "The state threw everything it had at Zimmerman," said Wall Street Journal. "When the police and local prosecutors originally decided he'd acted in self-defense, a nationwide uproar led to the appointment of a special prosecutor who charged Zimmerman with murder. President Obama added to the pressure for a conviction when he said that, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. Yet in the end, the jury gave Zimmerman a fair trial, even though he had become a symbol of our polarized racial politics." The outcome surprised no one, said USA Today, but still the fact remains that Martin was doing nothing wrong that February night in 2012 when he walked home from a convenience store carrying iced tea and a bag of Skittles, and Zimmerman told cops he'd spotted a blanking punk who looked suspicious, setting into motion a chain of events that left the teenager dead. The verdict may be legally justified, but it certainly isn't morally satisfying. What the columnist said. "Expect more tragic killings like this until we've repealed stand-your-ground laws in 24 states," said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrew.sullivan.com. "These laws encourage vigilantes to provoke confrontation, authorizing them to use lethal force if they believe their lives or safety are threatened, with no obligation to retreat. This trial has set a terrible precedent," said Charles P. Pierce in Esquire.com. "Zimmerman's acquittal has essentially given a hunting license to anyone who fears blanking punks and kids who wear hoodies at night in neighborhoods where they don't belong. This case was nothing but a show trial to satisfy race baiters," said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. "And the Justice Department should resist political pressure to stage a second one. Federal civil rights charges should be pursued only in rare, compelling cases where prosecutors or jurors have obviously ignored evidence of a hate crime. That's certainly not the case here. Even the FBI concluded after its own investigation that there was no evidence of racial motivation in Zimmerman's act of self-defense. So was the verdict fair? Asked Andrew Cohen in TheAtlantic.com. Millions of Americans are astonished that you can go looking for trouble in Florida, racially profile and shoot a young black man, and go free. But jurors can only act on the law and the evidence, which they did. Despite the attention sensational trials like this receive, they never fully answer the larger societal questions they pose or resolve the national debates they trigger. And the second article from the main stories, the Senate's agreement to blunt the filibuster. What happened? Senate Democrats' threat to use the nuclear option of revoking the minority's right to filibuster presidential appointees paid off this week, leading to a last-minute deal with Republicans to unblock 7 of President Obama's stalled nominations. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had threatened to unilaterally change Senate rules so that executive branch nominees could be approved with a simple 51-vote majority, preventing Republican-led filibusters that require 60 votes to overcome. But Reid backed down after some Senate Republicans agreed to allow a vote on the long-delayed confirmation of Richard Cordray as head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Senate Republicans also said they would allow up or down votes on 6 other nominees, including Gina McCarthy as head of the Environmental Protection Agency and Thomas Perez as Labor Secretary. In exchange, President Obama agreed to replace 2 nominees to the National Labor Relations Board, whom he had unilaterally named as recess appointments during a Senate break, a move the Republicans say was illegal. The deal to avoid the nuclear option was brokered by Senator John McCain, who persuaded 17 Republican senators to join Democrats in allowing Cordray's nomination to proceed. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had warned that changing the rules on filibusters would kill the Senate, hailed the agreement as an important moment. What the editorials said. Democrats should have made good on their threat to change Senate rules, said the New York Times. The filibuster has become a key tool of Republican obstructionism. Between 1976 and 2008, only 20 executive nominees were filibustered. 16 of Obama's have been. The Constitution set a 51-vote majority for approving legislation and appointees and did not intend to give the minority party a veto over president's team. The limited deal won't stop the GOP from blocking Obama's choices for a new Secretary of Homeland Security or chairman of the Federal Reserve. Democrats didn't technically pull the trigger, said the Wall Street Journal, but by simply threatening to, they have established a de facto majority vote rule. Now, every time the GOP threatens a filibuster, Harry Reid can reach for the trigger again. Make no mistake, Democrats have killed the filibuster against executive branch appointees. Republicans should remember that when they regain the presidency and a Senate majority. What the columnist said. This deal bodes well for the future, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. The Republicans' ideological hostility to basic governing has become so entrenched that it justified an extraordinary response, and Reid gave them one. Even Republican Senator Lindsey Graham admitted that Cordray was being wrongly filibustered because we don't like the law that created his agency. In short, Republicans are realizing they finally pushed their policy of total obstructionism too far, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The result is a total victory for the Democrats. Not exactly, said Jill Lawrence in NationalJournal.com. Senate Republicans have let Obama have his executive nominations, but they haven't given an inch where it really counts. on Obama's many unconfirmed nominees for the federal courts. Unlike Cordray, those appointees could influence history after he's gone. But Obama has hardly been treated unfairly by the GOP, said Hans A. von Spekowski in NationalReview.com. The last Congress confirmed 86% of his civilian nominees, including judicial and executive appointments, while the Democratic-led Congress approved only 67% of George W. Bush's nominees in 2007 and 8. The Democrats' hypocrisy is truly monumental. Why should the public give a darn about the procedural dust-up, asked Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com? Because this week's deal will have a real-world impact on the lives of real people. Cordray's nomination ends 2 years of questions over his financial watchdog's future and ensures that ordinary Americans will be protected from the predatory excesses of banks, mortgage companies, credit card companies, debt collectors, and other financial firms. The deal also represents incremental progress on ending our government's political gridlock. The Senate's deformation into an institution paralyzed by the filibuster is a defining symbol of Washington's dysfunction. Anything that moves the ball forward on that, even a little, is worth celebrating. And now we move on to the controversy of the week. Not unexpectedly, it is on the Zimmerman trial, Americans' enduring racial divide. The words black and white were never heard in the courtroom, but the trial of George Zimmerman for shooting and killing Trayvon Martin was all about race, said Paul Campos in Salon.com. From beginning to end, this tragic case revealed how black males are viewed by white Americans in the criminal justice system. Suppose for a moment that the roles of the two protagonists were reversed, and Martin was a 230-pound, 30-year-old black man with a gun who got into a struggle with an unarmed, 150-pound, 17-year-old white kid named Zimmerman. When the skinny white kid wound up dead, is there any chance that the nearly all-white jury would have brought the big, scary black man's claim of self-defense? For many African Americans, Zimmerman's acquittal is beyond shocking. It is earth-shattering, said Sophia Nelson in thedailybeast.com. It tells us that any black man can be lawfully shot dead if he's deemed suspicious. Why don't our white friends and co-workers understand how deeply alarming and disheartening this is? No one would have cared had Martin been shot by another black teen, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. This case only attracted the attention of the media and the race baiters because they saw it as an opportunity to indict America as a racist nation. Never mind that Zimmerman's mother is Hispanic, or that the evidence showed he fired his weapon only after Martin climbed on top of him, punching him and pounding his head into the pavement. The Zimmerman haters didn't care about facts or justice. They wanted a racial morality play. To create one, prosecutors and the media tried to turn Martin into a saint, said Jeffrey Cooner in the Washington Times. They circulated a photo of him as an angelic 12-year-old baby-faced boy. But at the time of his death, Martin was a 6'3" man-child with a history of drug use who had been suspended several times from school. If this wannabe thug had kept his cool and not tried to beat Zimmerman into a pulp, he'd still be alive today. That kind of demonization was why African Americans are so angry about this case, said Jonathan Capehart in the Washington Post. To avoid being thought of as dangerous thugs, black kids can't smoke pot, wear hoodies, get into fights, or make any of the same mistakes as white teens. And if black men of any age do frighten white people, we were reminded in this trial, cops or armed civilians can punish them with the death penalty. Be careful out there, my 71-year-old mother wrote me in a text following the verdict. I pray for your safety every day. When Barack Obama was elected, said Jelani Cobb in NewYorker.com, some people saw it as proof that America's racial divide had healed. But the fact that Martin was legally gunned down in a country that elected and reelected a black president doesn't diminish the black community's despair. It intensifies it. It tells us that even though African Americans have made huge progress, we are still outsiders in our own nation, guilty until proven innocent. Think of how it feels, said Janae Osterhelt in the Kansas City Star. When my husband goes out jogging in our suburban neighborhood after work, sometimes wearing a hoodie, I worry. Will an overzealous cop or vigilante see this beautiful black man with a Colgate smile as the Bible study leader and track coach that I married? Or will he look like just another hoodlum to hunt? And now the good week, bad week section. This was a good week for secessionists. After representatives from 8 rural Colorado counties began making plans to form a breakaway state, North Colorado to escape the state's gun control laws and oil industry regulations. This is not a stunt, said Weld County Commissioner Sean Conway. Our very way of life is under attack. It was a good week for outsmarting the NSA. After Russia's Secret Service ordered dozens of electric typewriters, saying that recent revelations about the U.S. National Security Agency's online surveillance program made them distrust computer communications. And a good week for waste management after British scientists invented a cell phone battery powered by urine. This is about as eco as it gets, said one researcher, noting that urine is a renewable resource. Indeed. And a bad week for inhaling, with the news that a specimen of the world's largest flower, the Titan arum, is about to bloom in the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington, D.C. To attract carrion insects, the flower emits a stench botanists liken to a very dead elephant. Bad week for the idea that more is better. After a New York City woman set off 21 bug bombs inside her apartment, causing an explosion that collapsed her five-story building, injuring 14 people. And a bad week for American Legacy Firearms, a gun maker that unveiled the Dallas Heritage Rifle to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Lee Harvey Oswald's assassination of President John F. Kennedy. If I hurt someone's feelings, I'm sorry, said company boss Steve Fahler, but I'm not going to worry about it. That brings us up to the briefing section. The headline today is Going to Mars. A private spaceflight company is soliciting volunteers to establish a human colony on Mars. Could it actually happen? Why go to Mars? The idea of a manned journey to Mars has animated science fiction for more than a century, and since the dawn of the space age, plans have been proposed for how it might be done. But for decades, any real momentum toward that dream seemed lost. In 1989, a plan advanced by President George H.W. Bush to send manned mission to the Red Planet was shelved when its costs were estimated to be more than $500 billion. In recent years, however, the prospects of a Martian voyage have been looking up. In 2010, the Obama administration called on NASA to set far-reaching exploration milestones, including sending astronauts to Mars by the mid-2030s. But NASA still has no budget for a manned mission, let alone the technology to land humans there safely and then bring them back. Several commercial spaceflight companies are working on plans to send people to Mars in about a decade. Former astronaut Buzz Aldrin believes it's possible. The challenge ahead is epic, but historic, he said. We're on a pathway to homestead the Red Planet. What would such a mission take? Just getting humans to Mars would require new solutions to some stiff challenges. At the closest point of their orbits, Earth and Mars are about 34 million miles apart, and astroengineers figure it would take a manned spacecraft 5 to 10 months to reach Mars. That is a long time for astronauts to be in interplanetary space where they'd need much tougher protection against cancer-inducing space radiation than they do in Earth's orbit. A trip to Mars would require vast quantities of equipment, food, and fuel. Some have suggested sending supplies separately to allow astronauts to travel in a lighter and faster vessel. But even if a manned mission reached Mars orbit in good order, landing there safely poses other daunting problems. Mars' atmospheric pressure is less than 1% of Earth's, making it difficult to slow a spaceship hurtling toward the surface at an estimated speed of 13,000 miles per hour. Unmanned rovers have cushioned their descents with heat shields, parachutes, and rockets, but current technology is insufficient for landing a much larger manned spacecraft, even if supplies were sent separately. We're talking about landing perhaps a two-story house, and then another two-story house with fuel and supplies right next to it, said former NASA technologist Bobby Braun. That's a fantastic challenge. How far have plans progressed? NASA teams are working on experimental projects with an eye to possible mission to Mars and back about 25 years hence. But some in the private sector don't want to wait that long. Multimillionaire space tourist Dennis Tito has hatched a low-budget, $128 million plan to send a 50-ish married couple on a 501-day flyby that would zoom past Mars in 2018 and then use the planet's gravities to slingshot the spacecraft back to Earth. More ambitiously, the Dutch nonprofit Mars One wants to start colonizing Mars within a decade, and has already collected more than 78,000 applications from civilians willing to take a one-way trip to Mars. The group plans to select six teams of four with the necessary intelligence, resourcefulness, courage, determination, and skill, as well as psychological stability. They would then undergo 7 years of training and testing, including time in mock Mars colonies, all to be chronicled in a revenue-yielding Survivor-style television series to make the final cut. Would living on Mars be dangerous? Scientists have serious concerns about the health risk of long-term exposure to radiation, reduced gravity, longer days, and extraterrestrial atmospheric conditions. Astronauts are known to experience bone degradation, muscle loss, and swollen optic nerves from spending too much time in zero gravity. A Russian-sponsored experiment called Mars 500, in which six men were confined for 500 days under conditions meant to emulate a Mars mission, showed that Mars travelers could face severe sleep disturbances, lethargy, and depression. Scientists also worry about the Martian surface's ultrafine dust, which contains highly chlorinated salts called perchlorates that can cause respiratory problems and thyroid damage. And there's a chance, however slim, that Mars harbors potentially virulent microbes. What would daily life on Mars be like? Martian colonists would need a base large enough to contain comfortable, long-term living quarters and a vast array of life support systems and supplies. They would have to construct their pressurized, airtight habitat in phases, much the way the International Space Station was built. A secure, long-term food supply would be crucial. One company is working on 3D printers that would combine powders and concentrates to create foods that replicate the textures, flavors, and smells of natural foods. Eventually, Martian farmers could grow food in pressurized greenhouses, using genetically modified crops to compensate for the planet's high radiation and low sunlight. Volunteers for the commercial mission say that the trade-offs in quality of life would be worth it. I've had a deep need to explore the universe since I was a kid, said Peter Greaves, a self-employed technologist. I envision life on Mars to be stunning, frighteningly lonely, quite cramped, and busy. But my experience would be so different from all 6 to 7 billion human beings. That by itself would make up for the factors I left behind. An insurance policy for human survival? Single planet species don't survive, said former astronaut John Grunsfeld. He is among the researchers, astronauts, and space exploration firms who see establishing an outpost on the red planet not just as a scientific challenge, but as essential to mankind's survival. Cosmologist Stephen Hawking thinks so too. The human race shouldn't have all its eggs in one basket, or on one planet, he says. Should nuclear proliferation, shrinking resources, a growing population, climate change, or a visit by hostile aliens threaten humankind on Earth, a colony on Mars could serve as a lifeboat to keep the species going. I believe that we will eventually establish self-sustaining colonies on Mars and other bodies in the solar system, Hawking says. But he figures it won't happen within the next 100 years. And now we take a look at best columns, the U.S. The first one, comparing the NSA to the Stasi, S-T-A-S-I. Is the National Security Agency the modern U.S. equivalent of East Germany's notorious secret police, the Stasi? Asked Charles Lane. The Stasi analogy is frequently used by activists in Germany and the U.S. who defend NSA leaker Edward Snowden, but as German Chancellor Angela Merkel pointed out last week, it's an absurd exaggeration. The Stasi aggressively spied on citizens to detect and punish even the pettiest deviations from official communist dogma. In that true surveillance state, the Stasi's sole goal was to suppress dissent and keep an unelected government in power. In the U.S., the NSA is focused on the very real threat of foreign terrorism. There's not a trace of evidence that it has used its powers for political purposes or personal vendettas. Snowden's revelations have sparked a useful debate about the trade-off of privacy and security. But even if we adjust NSA practices, the reality is that our country and all democracies will continue to engage in spying and surveillance. If Snowden and his camp don't understand the absurdity of their Stasi hyperbole, perhaps the truth will become clearer with each day that he spends in Vladimir Putin's Russia. That was by Charles Lane of the Washington Post. The next article comes from John Favreau of the DailyBeast.com. What if Obamacare doesn't fail? Why are Republicans so scared of Obamacare? Said John Favreau. The GOP has attempted to brand the health care law a train wreck, insisting that it's inherently unworkable. But if the GOP really believes that, why not just sit back, let it fail, and reap the political benefits of the public's wrath at the Democrats? The truth is that Republicans are terrified Obamacare could actually work. Already the law has provided 13 million Americans with rebates from insurance companies that overcharged them. And soon, insurers will not be allowed to refuse pre-existing conditions. More than 3 million happy young adults have been allowed to stay on their parents' health insurance until age 26. California and New York's insurance exchanges have already posted policies for the uninsured that are much cheaper than expected. Yet the anti-government zealots in the GOP are trying to block any attempt to educate the uninsured about how to sign up, and doing everything possible to frighten people about the program. Why? The evidence shows that if we as a nation want Obamacare to work, it will work. No wonder Republicans are so frantic. And the third column by Darshak Sanghavi of Slate.com. Why Women Have Late Abortions. Have abortion opponents ever considered why a woman might wait to terminate her pregnancy until after 20 weeks? Asked Darshak Sanghavi. Only 1% of all abortions occur later, yet Texas last week joined a growing number of other Republican-controlled states in setting 20 weeks as the legal limit. As pediatric cardiologist specializing in high-risk birth, I have worked with many women who've chosen to abort after 20 weeks. They wait that long not because of carelessness or heartlessness, but because comprehensive fetal testing, such as anatomical sonograms and heart ultrasounds, can't be reliably performed until around the 20th week. Only then do some women discover that their fetus has a severe brain malformation, missing organs, or devastating chromosomal problems. Though severe birth defects are rare, they affect thousands of pregnancies every year in Texas alone. The decision to terminate pregnancies in such cases is always heartrending. Now lawmakers have taken that decision away from parents, with an exception only for defects that would result in immediate death at birth. Do we really want to leave such judgments to politicians? And now we take a look at the last word. The topic this week, where the bull wins the fight. In Costa Rican bullfighting, say Ashley Harrell and Lindsay Fent, the crowd's favorite has four legs. Tonight, a Sunday night in March, the townspeople of a fishing village of Garza, Costa Rica, will empty out of the local Catholic church and congregate in a nearby field for an affair held in equal regard. They call it corrida, which literally means run. What it actually here means is rodeo. And these events largely resemble a typical American rodeo. But some people would call it a bullfight. They would not be entirely wrong. As in Spain, Costa Rican bullfighting is sometimes a fight to the death. But there are differences. There, bullfighting evolved as a sport for the elite. Man slays bull in a ritual sacrifice and is revered for taking dominion over nature. The bull never lives long enough to wrest the spotlight from the matador. Costa Rican bullfighting began as a diversion for farmers who couldn't afford to kill cattle for sport. And the spectacle is more about man's lack of control. Montadores, bull riders, not matadors, certainly aim to subdue and conquer the beast, and they are applauded when they manage to remain on top. But the bull reigns supreme. Those most adept at tossing, goring, or even killing riders are celebrated more than even the greatest montadores. Of all the bulls in Costa Rica, the most celebrated and revered is the bull people call Malacrianza. Translation, badass. Ask a regular rodeo attendant what it is about Malacrianza that makes him so beloved, and you might hear about his style and grace. Ask anybody else why Malacrianza is famous, and the answer is different. He killed people, explained a 7-year-old Costa Rican boy. His 1,700-pound body reveals intricate patterns of black and white speckles sweeping under his neck, over his colossal hump and around his haunches. His stunning coat and physique, along with his elegant stride and girthy skyward horns, make him seem otherworldly, oversized, iconic. Inside the home of Malacrianza's owner, Ubaldo Rodriguez, two enlarged framed photographs of Malacrianza hang opposite one of the Pope. On an afternoon in March, Ubaldo, a blue-eyed 63-year-old Costa Rican man in pressed plaid shirt and jeans, is seated cross-legged on the living room sofa across from his giddy, curly-haired wife, Amelia Gomez, who reclines in an armchair and does most of the talking. If you ask Amelia, the gentle old bull should have been retired last year. But Ubaldo just can't say no, she says. He isn't ready to give it up yet. Of all the things Ubaldo owns, a well-kept country home, 2 vehicles, 40 bulls, and nearly 2,000 acres of land, Malacrianza is perhaps the most valued and loved. Back in 2003, Ubaldo received Malacrianza as part of a bulk purchase of livestock. The bull and his companions had proven too aggressive for farm work at the Urbina family farm just down the road. For the Urbinas, aggressive bulls caused problems in the pasture and injured the other animals. For Ubaldo, though, an aggressive bull meant a better rodeo performance. Ubaldo waited until August 2004 to debut the bull at a corrida, taking him to Los Angeles de Nicoya in Guanacaste, a popular festival. The then anonymous bull entered the ring on one of the earlier days of the festival, putting on a graceful and belligerent show worthy of an encore later in the week. Soon, Malacrianza's distinctive style began to earn him accolades and nicknames. For instance, El Corazón de Garza, the Heart of Gaza, and Su Majestad, His Majesty. The most popular was as yet unearned, El Toro Asesino, the Bull Assassin. A typical festival features at least 10 bulls each night. The riders are in it for the thrill and bragging rights. On a typical night, they make only $30 to ride a bull whose natural aggression has been intensified by a 24-hour fest and a rope cinched uncomfortably tight around the midsection. The riders climb on the bull in a small pen beside the arena and then yell, "Puerta! Door!" The gate swings open and the bull runs into the ring, a rider clinging to his bare back, grasping only a rope and wearing spurs for balance. There are also dozens of pseudo-rodeo clowns called improvisados who enter the ring on foot. These professionals try to distract the bull from his instinctual inclination to gore a fallen rider. In addition, anyone from the audience can jump into the corral and become an amateur improvisado. The result is often a combination of chaos and comedy, but occasionally the improvisados are seriously injured. There is only one rule. Although the bull may kill you, no one kills the bull. Unlike American bull riding, the classic Guanacasteco rustic style of bull riding is not a timed event, nor are riders judged by an artificial set of standards. The public serves as the judge, explained announcer Lico Carrillo. You can just tell when a bull wins or when a rider wins. Victory is contingent on the adrenaline summoned in the crowd and on the overall impression a bull makes based on its size, demeanor, and how high it jumps, and how easily it throws the rider. Charisma and showmanship are as important as efficiency, though. Even if a bull shakes its rider quickly, it can't truly triumph unless it also puts on a good show. No bull in history has made more of an impression or put on a better show than Malacrianza. In July 2005, Juan Carlos Cubillo was one of the better-known riders in Guanacaste. Cubillo was recruited to Y Malacrianza in the grand finale at the San Vicente Festivals. When Cubillo was ready, he yelled, "Puerta!" and the portal sprang open. Malacrianza frenzied into the ring, bucking his back legs wildly and leaping into the air three times. On the third bound, the bull caught the edge of the gate with his hoof. At first, he seemed unfazed by the misstep, but in fact, he lost his balance, and his body began to twist. Malacrianza managed to leap off the ground once more before toppling onto his side. Cubillo, still on Malacrianza's back, landed under him, smacking his unprotected head against the dirt. Immediately after the fall, Malacrianza sprang back to his feet. With no interest in the unconscious Cubillo, the bull whipped around and charged an improvisado, knocking him over. Malacrianza continued to trot around the ring while two men grabbed Cubillo's arms and legs and carried his limp body away. Tocubio was rushed to the hospital and treated for excessive brain injuries. 2 days later, he was dead. Then came the last night of the Caimital de Nicoya Rodeo in December 2006. Jason Gomez, El Invisible, as he was known in bull riding circles for his ability to avoid injury, was chosen for Mala Crianza. After entering the ring on the bull, Gomez tried his best to lean back and avoid Mala Crianza's fearsome foot-long cachos, or horns, which he tended to hurl back at his riders. At first, Gomez kept his arms straight and his form rigid, but after two full-body bucks from Mala Crianza, the rider fell forward. In a rage, Mala Crianza flung his head back, jamming his left horn right into Gomez's neck. The rider fell from the bull and flopped onto the ground like a doll. A quick-thinking improvisado threw his cape at the bull. Gomez made it to the hospital alive, but bled to death before the doctors could save him. With two kills to his credit, El Toro Asesino had more than earned his nickname, and now the bull was famous all across Costa Rica. Mala Crianza, and by extension, Ubaldo, saved Costa Rican rodeo. The homicidal bull put Guanacasteco rodeo on the map at a time when interest in the sport was waning. Without Mala Crianza, it might even have disappeared altogether. But after the goring, newspapers and radio and TV stations began covering the sport widely. Although he failed to kill again, it did not matter. Mala Crianza was untouchable, a bovine superstar. Now 13, at an age which most bulls are long retired, Mala Crianza still reigns. Nearly a decade after he became a legend, he continues to draw a crowd wherever he goes. On this night in Garza, Mala Crianza's rider was Leonardo Bonilla, a 22-year-old matador who had been riding bulls since he was 12. Earlier in the day, when Ubaldo found out Bonilla would ride Mala Crianza, it made him nervous. Bonilla was widely regarded as a top montador for his endurance and showmanship, and that meant the fight would be duro, hard for his bull. Atop a sturdy wooden fence that doubles as front row seating, Guanacaste youth in sun-bleached curls fumbled with their iPhones. Behind them in the bleachers, fans moved over wooden planks to their seats, and vendors tempted them with ice cream, light-up wands, and yellow cotton candy. The scent of sizzling pork on a stick wafted through the arena, and cumbia music was alternated with hits by Pat Benatar and the Eagles. After an hour, the word Mala Crianza seemed to form on lips across the stadium, including those of the announcer, when Mala Crianza's signature cumbia entrance song finally boomed into the arena. Everyone reached for phones and cameras. Mala Crianza sprang out from behind the gate, head down, horns gleaming under the lights, a man on his back. He then flung himself up, all four hooves airborne, while simultaneously throwing his horns back at Bonilla, who held tight. Three more times the old bull jumped entirely off the ground. Mala Crianza's tail whipped furiously back and forth, and the dust of the arena, kicked loose by his hooves, seemed to hang like a shroud around him. People screamed and screamed, preparing themselves for the bull to do something obscene, something transformative, perhaps even to kill. Bonilla's body sagged, but his arms stayed taut, grasping the rope, his strong grip keeping him safe. Over and over, he was knocked forward onto Mala Crianza's hump, but he kept his balance, avoiding the horns and somehow staying upright. After 10 frantic seconds of commotion, Mala Crianza seemed suddenly to grow weary. He bucked a few lackluster times and then stopped. A dazed Bonilla took advantage of the pause and slipped off the back of the old bull, and then spun around and stepped quickly away. Only then did he wind up and fire a dramatic fist into the air to declare his victory. Improvisados rushed over to Bonilla, hugging him and hitting him on the back. Malacrianza circled the corral once, as if giving the audience one final photo opportunity. Then the door opened again, and he went through. But Bonilla did not come away unscathed, although he appeared to have little trouble staying on the bull for those few seconds when Malacrianza was bucking. For at least one brief moment, Malacrianza was young again. The Malacrianza celebrated in legend and song. He thrashed and jerked the rider so hard that he dislodged his forearm, wrenching it loose at the elbow. Although the rider had raised one fist in triumph, the other hung limply at his side. Malacrianza may have been defeated this time around, but make no mistake, he remains a badass. This entertaining article was brought to us by Ashley Harrell and Lindsay Fent at SBNation.com, a division of Vox Media. We turn now to the health and science section. The first article titled, The Bittersweet Benefits of Nostalgia. Feeling nostalgic is often seen as a sign of depression, but a growing body of research suggests that it actually wards off loneliness and anxiety. The New York Times reports, wistfully recalling old memories, researchers have found, makes people behave more generously and feel closer to their romantic partners. People are more likely to be nostalgic when it's cold outside, and feeling that way tends to make them feel warmer, suggesting a possible reason why nostalgia evolved. If you can recruit a memory to maintain psychological comfort, at least subjectively, that could be an amazing and complex adaptation, said psychologist Tim Wildschut of University of Southampton in England. He and his colleagues have found that nostalgic thoughts are remarkably similar across cultures, centering on memories of being surrounded by close friends at weddings, holidays, and other special moments. Such bittersweet reminiscences are often triggered by feelings of isolation and are most common among people experiencing a transition, such as young adults moving away from home, or old people who've lost a spouse. Despite arising from a sense of loss, nostalgia seems to make us feel better. It brings to mind cherished experiences, says North Dakota State University psychologist Clay Routledge, that assure us we are valued people who have meaningful lives. Next, how exercise calms the brain. Exercise is known to combat anxiety, but scientists have long been puzzled by why that's so. Physical activity creates excitable new neurons in the hippocampus, a part of the brain that regulates emotion, thinking, and memory. And in theory, having more of these neurons should make people more anxious. But when Princeton researchers compared the neurons grown in the brains of mice that regularly ran on a wheel with those in sedentary mice, CBSNews.com reports, they found that the active mice gained more of a particular type of neuron that releases the neurotransmitter GABA, which keeps other young neurons from becoming overactive. When both groups of mice were exposed to stress in the form of a cold bath, their excitable neurons lit up as expected. But unlike the sedentary mice, the fit mice also released a large amount of GABA, which quickly quelled their anxiety. Researchers think routine exercise changes human brains similarly, helping us relax in the face of stress. When singing is truly heartfelt. As choir singers harmonize, their breathing and heartbeat synchronize in time with the music, creating a rewarding feeling of oneness. That's the conclusion of a new study by Swedish researchers who strapped heart rate monitors on 15 young choral singers. The singers were asked to perform three exercises: humming, singing a popular national hymn, and chanting a mantra. Researchers found that the pulses of the singers increased and decreased together as the music's tempo changed. When the songs required the singers to breathe in unison, their heartbeats were especially aligned. The controlled breathing that singing demands also seems to have a calming influence on singers. Songs with long phrases achieve the same effect as breathing exercises in yoga. Study author Bjorn Wyckoff of the University of Gothenburg tells the Daily Telegraph, "In other words, through song, we can exercise a certain control over mental states. The lungs and the heart communicate with the brain via the vagus nerve, which also helps regulate emotion." Wyckoff says that link could explain why group singing strengthens solidarity, not just in choirs, but among football fans and work crews. "When you're singing together," he says, "you are synchronizing with other people and harmonizing your hearts." And we wind down today's program with the talking points. One article here: sex scandals. Why disgraced politicians run? "A little disgrace never hurt anyone, especially in New York City," said Connor Simpson and Philip Bump in TheAtlantic.com. Perhaps that's why the latest poll numbers show that former Representative Anthony Weiner, best known for tweeting photos of his crotch to women, is now leading the race for New York mayor. At the same time, Eliot Spitzer, who resigned as New York governor in 2008 after getting caught patronizing high-priced prostitutes, is now leading the race for city comptroller. How can this be? Thanks to their nationally publicized sex scandals, the Fallen Golden Boys have great name recognition. Their opponents are fairly dull, second-tier city officials no one knows. No one really saw this coming, but next year, New York City might be run by two Democrats famed for dropping their pants. "You have to wonder what makes these guys tick," said John F. Harris and Alexander Burns in Politico.com. After the national humiliation Weiner and Spitzer brought on themselves, they should have buried themselves in some anonymous do-good work. But the same obsessive hunger that drove these men to sexual excess and disaster also makes them seek public approval and power. They satisfy that hunger by winning elections. For narcissists like Weiner and Spitzer, and for Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, and Mark Sanford before them, anonymity is agony. New Yorkers don't have to like Weiner and Spitzer to vote for them, said Joanna Weiss in the Boston Globe. Voters might just decide that in ruthless big city politics, it's best to be represented by a politician so egomaniacal that he's willing to anger a lot of powerful people. Americans may be finally shifting toward a French-like indifference toward their leaders. Extramarital exploit, said USA Today in an editorial. In a Gallup poll from a few years back, 46% of respondents said it would bother them not much or not at all if a presidential candidate had an extramarital affair. The risk for voters is that the more forgiving they become, the more brazen and shameless their elected officials may get. True, but at least guys like Weiner and Spitzer aren't boring, says Walter Shapiro in Yahoo.com. After years of partisan gridlock in Washington, voters may crave the mindless entertainment of a summer blockbuster. And boy, is New York City politics providing it. Guantanamo. Is force-feeding torture? How horrible is it to be force-fed, said Emily Greenhouse in NewYorker.com. To find out, Yasin Bey, the hip-hop performer formerly known as Mos Def, agreed to be filmed undergoing nostalgic feeding last week to highlight what is being done to 45 of the 80 detainees currently on hunger strike in Guantanamo Bay. The video is extremely uncomfortable to watch. Bay's body and head are strapped to a chair while a 2-foot-long feeding tube is forced into his nose and down his throat. He writhes, pleads, and breaks down, weeping. Federal Judge Gladys Kessler ruled last week that she lacked jurisdiction to end the force feeding, said Charles P. Pierce in Esquire.com. Nonetheless, Kessler condemned the practice as painful, humiliating, and degrading, and called it a form of torture that violates international law. She urged President Obama to order a stop to force feeding, and if he had any conscience left, he would. Nasogastric feeding is not torture, said Mark A. Thiessen in the Washington Post. Doctors and nurses use the same technique to feed thousands of patients in hospitals across the United States every day. If sick children and old folks can handle a tube up their nose, so can the big, tough Al-Qaeda terrorist at Guantanamo Bay. Clearly, Yassin Bey has particularly sensitive nostrils, said Ian Tuttle in NationalReview.com. Or perhaps he decided to ham it up for the cameras. But his publicity stunt didn't change the fact that military doctors have a medical obligation to force-feed detainees, just as they would not stand idly by while a prisoner hanged himself. The doctors are simply doing their medical duty by keeping the prisoners alive. It's more humane to let them starve, said Steve Chapman in Reason.com. The detainees' lives belong to no one but them, and they've concluded that it's better to die than to be condemned to the endless limbo of despair at Guantanamo. Ahmed Babecha, one of the striking inmates, has been cleared for release since 2007, but he can't go home to Algeria because he fears he would be tortured or killed there. And we've come to the end of our time today for this episode of the week. Please be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.